This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 46, for Monday, December 29th, 2008. Use Cases. This week we bring you an interview about use cases and how they fit in the software development lifecycle. We talk with Matt Tursky, the president and co-founder of Serlio Software. Let's listen in. Hey, this is Larry, and I'm recording this podcast at a local coffee shop in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm here with my buddy Matt. Matt, can you introduce yourself?
I am Matt Tursky, president of Serlio Software, makers of Case Complete.
And Matt, I reached out to you. I wanted to talk a little bit about use cases and requirements gathering today. And I know that you're a little bit of an expert in that field, and so wanted to get you on the show so we could talk about some of the upfront part of the software design process. So can you tell us how you got started with use cases and requirements gathering?
I was first introduced to use cases when I was working for Rational Software, which is where a number of the Serlio co-founders came from. And obviously, one of the three amigos behind the UML, Ivar Jakobsen, is the creator of the use case concept, and that's where I first learned about use cases and really became introduced to it and pretty fascinated with a really different sort of way of looking at requirements gathering.
Yeah, prior to use cases, and this is like I started by looking at Ivar Jakobsen's early works as well. Part of use cases, all requirements were huge and pretty much unreadable. Mm-hmm. And so what differentiates, a use case from one of those old documents that, that used to be measured by the inch?
Sure. The biggest differentiator with use cases is that it takes an outside-in approach as opposed to an inside-out approach. So we start by looking at who needs to use the system. That's question number one in a use case approach. You then look at what are their goals or what are they trying to achieve with your system. That's, kind of the second high-level step. And then the third step is just figuring out how are they going to go about achieving those goals. So, it really seems pretty simple in hindsight, but it's 180 degrees different from a traditional way of looking at a requirements spec. And it has this added benefit that, most people have heard of this, the magical 7 ± 2 number of things that you can keep in your short-term memory. And if you think about a traditional requirements spec, which may be several inches thick and often looks like a bulleted or hierarchical numbered list, there's clearly more than 7 items in there. And if you're really going to try to read and absorb a spec like that, by the time you've read a page, you've kind of overflowed your short-term memory, and it's difficult to read and absorb that sort of thing, which is the first time I was exposed to use cases was as a developer, not as a use case author. And I thought, well, this is a much easier way for me to look at how a piece of functionality needs to be built rather than looking at specs, which may require me to look at, different pieces throughout a very large document, pull those together into the relevant pieces to produce a design. So,
yeah, because a traditional spec covers the typical case and then tries to shove in every atypical case, possible in there, and probably half those get missed.
Right.
Whereas a use case, the typical one is one use case. Mm-hmm. The atypical ones are actually different use cases in a lot of cases, right?
Or variations or extensions on a single use case. And even if it may not be common to have your what we call a main success scenario, or some people call the happy path, it may never happen or it may rarely happen. It still is important to document it that way, because at least the reader, whether it's a tester or a manager or a developer, can get that piece of the spec and understand how it's supposed to work when everything goes right. And with that foundation of understanding, you can then look at, okay, what are all the special cases and all the exception cases that we need to handle around this specific use case.
So I know there's some specific terms with a use case. Mm-hmm. An actor, for instance.
Right.
Can you run through those?
Sure. An actor is anything that needs to interact with your system in order to get something done. And I note that I said thing. It isn't necessarily a person or a human being. It could be another system or another component or a piece of technology. But it's really anything that your system, that's going to interact with your system to get something done. So if you think about it, by defining who all of your actors are, you're really defining the scope of your system and what is in and what is out of your system.
Right, and that's there's also like a glossary of actors, right?
Sure, sure. Well, a glossary really is just the common vocabulary to your particular domain that you're gathering requirements for. For insurance is a great example. There's lots of specific terminology to certain industries, be it insurance or something else. And you, as an outsider, you might assume that everybody agrees on what those special terms mean. And what I found is more often than not, people have different ideas of what very specific terms mean. So having a glossary is really an essential part of really having a spec that is going to be widely and easily understood.
Yeah, so let's follow up with your example that you started on there with the insurance industry. The term insured, you know, means something to, myself, right? I think an insured would be the patient, right?
Right.
But in insurance industry terms, that's not necessarily the patient. It could be the, the person who is dependent on the insured, right?
Right.
The insured is the person who carries the policy, not necessarily the person getting services.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other actors, like the provider. You know, we would think of a provider as a doctor normally, but the provider doesn't have to be a doctor. It could be the lab that's providing services for the what we traditionally consider the provider.
Exactly. And it's small misunderstandings like that in a spec that will lead to big problems down the road. Whenever I'm trying to sell somebody on the idea of doing use cases or requirements, I bring up this often cited statistic. I shouldn't say statistic because I can't have a citation for it right now. But the idea that fixing defects or fixing problems in the requirements phase are, an order of magnitude or 10 times less effort filled than having to fix something in a design phase as opposed to having to fix something down in the development phase or in the testing phase. So the earlier you catch these things, the cheaper they are going to be to fix. And again, having a common understanding of these terms and words is really key to doing that.
That's a typical chart that you see that, like, a bug caught in the requirements phase is $1.
Right.
In the coding phase, it's $10. In the testing phase, it's $100. In production, it's $1,000 or whatever.
Right, right.
Typical stacked bar graph. It, again, you don't need the actual mathematics to show you that it's just cheaper to catch it earlier, right?
Right. Right. It's better not to make the mistake to begin with than to make it and fix it down the road.
Yeah, and it's funny that, we think that we've, in software we've got this, great epiphany with this, but we've been doing this in building architecture for years. I always like to point to Frank Lloyd Wright's famous quote as the architect's two greatest tools are the eraser at the drafting board and the wrecking bar at the job site.
Right. It's a lot easier to change a requirement or to fix a requirement than it is to fix a piece of code that's been deployed.
Yeah, you look at it on the drafting board, you go, oh, that's wrong, you can erase it. As opposed to, that beam is in the wrong place when you've actually built the building.
Right.
You could kill somebody. That would be the worst part about it.
Mm-hmm.
So a use case is obviously, very early on in the process. This is a tool, before you say file new project in Visual Studio, right?
Right, right. So a use case, we're talking about terms. A use case really describes how an actor is going to go about achieving one of their goals. And it can be written in many forms. Use case writing is really just another form of writing, and you could be very, very open, just write small stories, write a little bit of prose about how something's going to get done, or often it's broken down into a set of steps, just because writing in steps, numbered steps particularly, are easier to test against and easier to track changes against. But really a use case is a story. It describes one way that one actor is going to use your system to get something done.
Would it be a synonym with a user story?
It could be, and I'm parsing my words, or I'm answering carefully because when it comes to methodology and Big M methodology, people are very particular about what certain terms mean and what user stories are versus use cases. I take a more lax and open approach that, hey, a use case is just me saying to somebody, okay, tell me how you need the system to work. You know, tell me a short story about, you know, how Larry is going to go about, you know, applying for some insurance or doing something else. And if you want to call that a use case or you want to call it a user story, you know, I'm okay with either of those.
Matt's looking over his shoulder to see if there's a group of Agilista ninjas about to bust in on us.
Right.
Because I think that's where some of the tension is a lot of people see use cases as part of RUP, you know, this big methodology that big companies apply,
right.
Whereas user stories are, you know, more agile, small team, more flexible, we get things done quicker. And I think what you're saying is, and this is what I personally believe also, is that they accomplish the same goal. If you want to call it a use case or a user story, as long as you, you know, are true to the, you know, the outcome that you're trying to achieve, that it doesn't matter what you call it.
Right. Essentially, it comes down to asking, who needs the user system? How are they, and how are they going to use it? And it's funny you mentioned that because I was talking with somebody a few weeks ago, and we're talking about use cases and really how great they were. And then the person I was talking to was really kind of a use case lover, or was really into use cases. And I asked him if he was using use cases at his current company, and he said, "Oh no, we're really not ready for that. We're too lightweight, or we don't really get into heavyweight methodologies." And so. So clearly there is that perception, and it's a perception that I try to fight, because from where I'm sitting, I think use cases are the most effective and easiest and lightest weight way to gather your requirements without a lot of extra overhead.
Yeah, and I think it's you shouldn't confuse the two. You know, use cases are part of the RUP methodology, but you don't have to use the RUP methodology to use use cases.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I want to clear up is that, you know, where use cases come from,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, if I'm the systems analyst or whatever you want to call it, the person responsible for developing the use cases, who should I be talking to get my information?
You're really talking to domain experts or people who understand the system you're building. And obviously that varies greatly depending on your domain. So it may be, you know, if you're working in insurance, you're probably going to talk to somebody who understands the business. If you're building, you know, some sort of scientific application or, you know, some sort of other application, I guess the idea is you just need to talk to somebody who understands the problem that needs to be solved and can explain it to you in a way that,
Yeah, and the key thing of me asking the question was, you know, this is not an IT or app development, you know, thing that they do on their own. Right, like, you know, a traditional specification where,
right.
you know, the guy starts from scratch and says, this is how I want the system to be.
Right.
I mean, a use case should come from, you know, the person with the expertise about the system under design.
Right. The person who understands the domain may not write the use case because they understand the domain. Their skills aren't in how to gather a requirement or how to write a use case. But essentially, that's where it does come from.
Yeah, I talk about quite a bit when I'm talking to people about what a software architect does. Is part of our job, and you've been a software architect for years, is translating between the business language and the technology language.
Right.
And I see the use case as a key tool in the translation process.
Exactly. It is a form of a requirement that you can take to a senior level stakeholder, a business executive, and they can look at it, they can read it, they can understand it, and it's not, you know, a spec that's hard to digest or, you know, a big document that a senior level executive is not going to want to read or have the time to read. You can take it to a developer. A developer could really read it and understand it. Tester. That really is the whole idea behind the use case, is it bridges the gap between people who understand the problem and people who need to design, test, and deploy the solution.
And one of the key strengths is that it codifies what's supposed to be done. Because if you look at requirements from a business user or a domain expert,
right.
you know, they're going to come in a lot of different forms, right? And the use case is a way of taking all those different forms and codifying it so a developer can build against that.
Right. And they're technology agnostic. And there are cases, I don't want to get too far off on a tangent, where there isn't even software to be built, but people will use cases just to do some sort of business process engineering or, you know, looking at how workflows and what sort of tasks people are working on in a certain domain or at a certain company.
Yeah, it's interesting that in my career, you know, I've been doing this like 17 years, we've actually had situations where, you know, we've actually developed some business process use cases and then some technology use cases.
Mm-hmm.
The technology use cases were subsets of the business process one.
Mm-hmm.
But we've, you know, absolutely, just like you've said, we've done implementations to process just using use cases as our, you know, vehicle for describing what needs
right.
to be changed.
There are so many places where you can use use cases that...
Well, Matt, they sound like the absolute perfect tool, but I'm going to put you on the spot as a, mm-hmm. as a use case expert, somebody who, you know, spends all their time, you know, not only practicing with use cases, but, you know, we're going to talk about your tool in a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're actually building tools for use cases.
Right.
What are the downfalls, you know, to use cases? What are some of the pitfalls that people run into?
Well, first of all...
If you say they're perfect, I'll come up with a list for you, and you can retort.
Not at all. First of all, there's this misconception that use cases really are about stick men and ovals. And if people who have seen what a use case diagram looks like, which is just the UML notation for describing what actors you have and what use cases you have, if you haven't seen a diagram, it's basically your actors are stick men, and your use cases are ovals, and there are lines between the stickmen and ovals. And I think there's this perception that requirements gathering can now be done by just drawing stickmen and ovals, and while that sounds very, you know, a lot easier than writing a big fat spec, that really isn't the case, that there still is a lot of meat behind those use cases that needs to be specified.
Yeah, the narrative is much more important, but the pictorial is good because you can look at it at a glance and get a good understanding of what the, you know, what the narrative is supposed to tell you.
Exactly. And it gives you, it's a roadmap of all of your requirements. And again, it's another benefit over a traditional spec in that you can look at a use case diagram and at least get that view of who needs to use the system, what are all the different things they need to do. And then you can drill in as appropriate and get the detail where you need to, as opposed to trying to digest something that's a lot bigger and denser.
Another pitfall, this is one I've experienced, is people who write use cases that are too long,
mm-hmm.
that they try to do a traditional spec in the form of a use case.
Right.
I can tell you personally, I've been on like, you know, page 8 of a use case.
Exactly.
And thought, man, this guy really missed the point of this.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's possible, like anything, to use a tool in the wrong way. That, you know, I love .NET, I love C#, and it's perfectly acceptable, or not acceptable, but possible to write a very bad program with those tools. Likewise, with use cases, it's possible to write bad requirements. And so we have this concept of smells in use cases, kind of like Martin Fowler's smells in code, that there's often not a one right way or a wrong way to write a use case, but they kind of start to smell bad when they have certain characteristics. And most use cases, or a good use case, I say, is between 6 and 10 steps. Nothing super magical about that number. You can certainly have something outside of that bounds, but once you have more than 10 steps, it starts to smell a little funky, and I kind of like raise an eyebrow. And if it has 20 plus steps, I say, well, this use case smells really bad. We need to look at it, refactor it, rewrite it.
Right. It could be several use cases that you're trying to shove into one.
Exactly. Right? And there's a lot of refactoring that goes on as you're gathering requirements and building use cases. We like to say that requirements gathering isn't a matter of writing things down. It's a process of discovery. You're really discovering, you know, what problem you're trying to solve and how you're going about solving it. And there's going to be a lot of rewriting, a lot of reworking, and that's just part of the use case process, or any requirements gathering process, really.
I think one of the other criticisms is that, and again, this isn't criticism of the use case, you know, artifact itself, but, you know, of the application to it, is that people who describe a system at too high a level in a use case,
mm-hmm.
like if I can grab your document and replace the word insurance claim mm-hmm. with the word bank account, and it still, you know, describes the system at a high level,
right?
I probably didn't gather enough of the meat of what the application's supposed to do,
right? You know, your use case really needs to be something that, or let me back up. You have to think about who's going to consume and who's going to read that use case when you're done. Often they're written by business analysts or business experts. They're going to be read by software developers and by software testers and maybe by managers who need to understand, okay, how am I going to design something that's going to satisfy this requirement, or how am I going to test this? And that's a bit of a litmus test, that if the use case doesn't have that sort of detail or isn't written at that level, then it's probably not a good use case.
Right. Can there be too many use cases?
That's a good question. I suppose it's possible to have so many that they become unmanageable, and you may wind up finding it more effective to break your system down into a set of components or subsets to do that. So I guess, yes, it certainly is possible to have too many use cases. Maybe you need to consolidate some, or maybe you need to write some use cases at high level that will expand out eventually to lower level use cases.
Or maybe you're writing unit tests already, you know?
Right, right.
You know, that you're probably going too deep into what the system does.
Right.
I think I actually experienced this, you know, personally, that with the other extreme is that, you know, somebody describing a social network site in four use cases,
mm-hmm.
you know, user logs in, you know, user adds friends, you know, it's like,
right.
Well, dude, what's,
right.
How is this going to be different, you know?
Right. I do have a post on my blog, or actually on the Case Complete blog, that addresses this step, that you can write use case steps at too fine-grained a level or too coarse-grained a level, and of course the right answer is to find that just right level of granularity for each step to keep the use case moving forward so people can actually read it without getting bored out of their mind, but not being so high-level that the steps really lose all meaning because they don't contain any detail.
Right. Or they're written in too technical of a jargon or something like
right,
that. Yeah.
Right. Another, I don't know if this is a weakness or just the reality of use cases, is that use cases specify functional requirements. They don't specify non-functional requirements. So if you wanted to think about, you know, the whole requirements universe for a system, you break them down into functional and non-functional. There's an acronym for the non-functional part that I first read in a book by Craig Larman. I don't know if he's the original creator of this, but it's FERPs. And the idea is you have these different sort of requirements. You know, each for the first letter in this acronym FERPS, it's functional requirements, usability requirements, reliability requirements, performance requirements, and all the other requirements that don't really relate to the behavior of your system.
Right.
You still need to capture those, but often those requirements are somehow related to a use case or some certain functionality that you have. So it's good to be able to track those and keep them together.
So can we talk a little bit about Case Complete?
Of course we can talk about Case Complete.
So as of this recording in Visual Studio 2008 SP1, which is the shipping Microsoft product, mm-hmm. there's no use case template or use case model in
right.
any of our versions. You've actually got a tool that'll help you write use cases, right?
Right.
Tell us about it.
Well, essentially what we're trying to do is do what Quicken does for balancing your checkbook. So I got to ask you a question, Larry. If you ever had a day off and you really, you know, the kids were doing something else, it was a day for yourself, would you ever fire up Visual Studio and just write code just because you wanted to?
I know people that do. Me personally, no.
So, and Damon's raising his hand over here. Anyhow, so. You know, people will write code just because they like to. They're enthusiasts, and developers are very passionate about what they're doing that way. If I would ask most either developers or business analysts or anybody who's responsible for writing requirements, if they had a day off, would they ever say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go write myself some use cases or some requirements. The answer is no, they wouldn't do that. People don't feel the same way about writing use cases or gathering requirements as they might feel about writing code or some other passion of theirs. So what we're trying to do is take a task that you really need to get done and make it as easy and painless and as productive as possible.
Okay.
And that's what Case Complete does. So it started when we were doing some training at Serlio on use cases and requirements gathering, and we taught a number of public courses, and students would ask at the end of the course, really, what's the best tool for gathering use cases? And really, the most common tool is to use standard
Word.
Office products.
Yeah. Word
Excel,
PowerPoint.
And that sort of thing. And there are, you know, if you Google for use case templates, you will find plenty of templates out there for writing use cases in an Office tool.
Visio actually ships with some templates for use cases.
Sure,
you know.
Sure. And those solutions work when you have, say, five use cases. But if you're going to really really use cases to develop a non-trivial system, you're probably going to have 20, 50, you know, we have customers with hundreds of use cases in a system. It really becomes difficult and almost not possible to manage that number of use cases and that many requirements using standard Office tools.
What you're missing is, you know, because the tools themselves will let you create the use case, create the narrative, create the visual.
Right.
You're missing that catalog component, right?
Right, right. You need something a little bit more than a place to gather your requirements. So obviously that's the first sort of thing that you need is a place to put them. But once you have them, you need to be able to search on them. You need to be able to analyze them and do sorts of cross-referencing. I'd mentioned earlier that there's different kinds of requirements. You need to have ways to search and do traceability and make sure that you can see, get the right view of all your requirements at just the right time.
So you guys started the company. You were doing training on use cases. You know,
right.
People were coming to you as, you know, industry experts on this.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have seen an opportunity, right? If people were saying, you know, what's the best tool? And
we did, and that's exactly where the impetus for building the tool came. Is I didn't have a good answer for students who were asking, what tool do you recommend for writing use cases? And we said, well, okay, here's an opportunity. Let's build one. And we took a very grassroots, sort of ground up approach. And, you know, built the tool while we were continuing to do the other work we were doing and got people interested in it. And, you know, over the past, say, 4.5 years now that we've released Case Complete, interest has steadily grown. And we're at a point where we have, you know, customers in about 50 different countries gathering requirements with Case Complete now.
50 different countries, yeah.
Over 500 customers.
Yeah, I remember we ran into each other last year, about 14, 15 months ago, mm-hmm. and you'd mentioned that there was some African country in Central Africa. And you
Maldives.
Like, yeah. Yeah. You're like, if I've got a customer there, I think we've gone worldwide now.
Right. We've gone worldwide, and I get really excited because I'll ask myself, hey, if somebody in Maldives needs to gather use cases and write requirements, then gosh, the worldwide market must be just phenomenal. So it's pretty exciting that way. And in a way, when orders come in, it's kind of a geography lesson for all of us at Cirlio. We have to sometimes look up where these countries are.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about your application, because I think that in addition to being interested in use cases, that a lot of our listeners have expressed interest in the process of developing software.
Because
I think we're all fundamentally entrepreneurs. We all want to build the next great video game,
right,
or, you know, next great web application, right? Mm-hmm. Yours is an installable application.
It is.
It's not a web-based.
It's a Windows Forms client, so it's an installed application. It's not a web-based application. And
so it's a .NET app.
Yes.
Which version of the framework did you start on?
We started on, gosh, you know, whatever was shipping, say, 4.5 years ago. It was probably a 1.1 app,
yeah,
I think, to start with. And it's currently built on with Visual Studio 2005, so we're looking to
time to upgrade, Matt.
We are. I don't want to make this is a don't infer this as a as some sort of commitment, but most likely the next release of Case Complete will be in written with Visual Studio 2008.
So, is this a Visual Studio integrated application or is it standalone?
It is a standalone application at this point, and we have looked at integrations, and you had mentioned, you know, talking a little bit about the entrepreneurial side or the business side that a technical person like us has to think about. And, you know, there's this, you look at all the integrations, and there are certainly upstream and downstream tools we need to think about, and, you know, testing tools people might want to plug in with, things like Team System, because, you know, you don't have a good use case story there for doing that. And there's always a question of, okay, how much time do we spend on integrating with other products versus pouring, you know, what effort we do have into the product and adding features that make us better stand alone.
Right. Well, and I gotta think that if you look at the typical person developing use cases, a lot of them are going to be architects like you and me,
mm-hmm.
that have Visual Studio installed and
right.
running. But if you were to take a dependency on Visual Studio, you would cut out a lot of the business analysts
exactly.
from your potential market pool
right.
that don't necessarily have that tool installed.
Right.
So anytime, you know, I think that's a general thing, that anytime you take a dependency on another software application that's not free,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you're going to limit your market share. Even if you take a dependency on a tool that's free,
Right.
Visual Studio has got, you know, the Express product, so you could always tell people to download that. Anytime you take that, well, actually, it doesn't allow add-ins, so that would be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you take a dependency like that, you've got to think about the long-term implications of that dependency.
Right. Yeah, I've got to take off my technical hat and put on my business hat, because
right.
there are some integrations that would be really cool. I mean, I'd love to see us running inside of, you know, Team System and do that, but, you know, from a business side, I want as big a market as I can possibly get, you know, because we're a small startup, you know, we need to get to as many people as we can, and I really don't want to encounter anything that's going to limit or prevent somebody from using our tool or our technology.
Yeah, Eric Sink had a great article. We'll put it in the show notes a few years ago, talking about the market size,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you know, he was talking about the fact that SourceGear was targeted for developers.
Mm-hmm.
So instantly he shrunk his market from the world to people who write code.
Right.
Which is a huge, you know, jump down. So, mm-hmm. you know, anytime that you take on a limitation like that, you know, you got to have a higher percentage of the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm sure with Case Complete, you'd love to have 10% of the, you know, the IT market share. I mean, that would be huge for you guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned developers, because we're all developers. We started, you know, Cirilio Software, and we're writing this tool. And initially, we were targeting other developers when we were trying to sell and market it. And, you know, the fact is, I understand that software developers want to design and want to code solutions. They're not really interested in requirements, except to the extent that they help them do those two things.
Right.
And so they're never really going to get excited about gathering requirements to use cases. And really, the right market is business analysts and people. You know, that business analyst I find is a role kind of like software architect, that if you ask 100 people what a business analyst is, they all have a slightly different definition. But clearly it is different than a developer or a pure technical person. And really it's a growing, burgeoning profession, and it's something we're really trying to tap into from a marketing perspective and who we're focusing on building the tool for.
So let me ask you a couple of quick questions about more the entrepreneurial side of your business,
because sure.
I'm interested in, you've got a worldwide tool. You're mm-hmm. in 50 countries.
Right.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Do you have to deal with language issues, internationalization, localization, stuff like
we
that?
We do have to, and, you know, we handle that. It's an internationalized application. And we have to handle really sort of things that you might not think of initially. We have a dictionary, for example, so we can catch misspelled words and give them red squigglies. And we ship with an English version, but if you're writing use cases in German, that's not going to work for you. So we had to, you know, make sure that customers could get different versions of, you know, the dictionary to work. Yeah, we also have this issue recently with part of our diagramming capabilities and components, in that Arabic characters are not appearing in the right order. I just thought of it because it's something we were working on this morning. So, yeah, that is, I don't want to say the downside, because I'm glad to have a worldwide market, but you become acutely aware that not everybody speaks English and writes in the English language if they're going to use their tool. And again,
well, also, you know, you know, when you talk about German, even though it's a different language, most of the characters are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You get into double byte languages, and it's a whole different world.
Right.
Fortunately, the framework takes care of a lot of that for you. But mm-hmm. there's still things like right to left, left to right.
Right. Right.
You know, that are, you know, that are issues. So I think it's interesting. And your application's got roots 4.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys must have been really forward thinking, you know, and looking at some of these issues, or maybe along the way you've had to make some
yeah,
changes.
I'd like to say we were forward thinking, but we're sharp and hard working. So that I'll take, you know, I'll put it that way, that when we find issues or when we make dumb mistakes or don't take the right move, we're wise enough to go back and correct and fix what we did wrong.
Okay, so you had to like reinvest, you know, for as your audience has gone more global.
Sure.
So is your application, is it written in English? And or do you do translations of your menus and things like that?
Oh, so to be clear, the menus and the application itself doesn't display in other languages or other sorts of characters. But that isn't too much of an issue. We haven't had too much pushback on that, because the application really is so focused on content. Again, if you think of something like Microsoft Word, you look at your screen, and you're seeing mostly
what you
user
written.
Input content.
Right.
And as long as the users can gather and write what they need to write in their native language, they're happy.
Cool. I figured that, but I wanted to ask about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that you'd have a special, you know, evaluation, you know, free 30-day trial for thirsty developer listeners.
I'd love to give a plug. So Case Complete, you know, we sell it over the internet. You know, we find out most of our customers. Actually, most of our customers find us when they're doing searches on requirements and use cases and that sort of thing. And we offer a 30-day free trial. It's a fully functional version of the software. And
so it doesn't do anything ridiculous. Like you can do everything, but you can't print it.
As a developer, no. It's a very clean install. So I thought you were going down the track of is there spyware or something in there?
No.
But no, it is a 100% functional version. In fact, if you decide to buy, that's all we do is we send you a key that unlocks it after 30 days, so you can continue to run it. And it's a very clean install, uninstall. So if you're somebody like me who is leery of installing a lot of software on your system, you try to keep it fairly clean. If you decide you don't like it, you can uninstall it, and there will be no remnants of it left. You won't have any sort of crud sitting around. So if you're into use cases, or basically what I tell folks is, if you're writing use case documents anyhow, you might as well give the tool a try, because it can literally pay for itself inside of a week in terms of how much productivity gain you'll get, as opposed to wrestling with Microsoft Word or something and templates and trying to put together a use case.
And 30 days is a good kick the tire period, right?
It is. So. It is. I sometimes wonder if it's too long, because people download it and then I think they say, "Oh, I've got 30 days," and they wait until the 25th day and say, "Hey, can you send this trial for us or something?" But anyhow. By all means, download the trial and take it, kick the tires, take it for a run.
And you guys also do a lot of of thought leadership on use cases. And,
right.
You mentioned the blog earlier, but can you go ahead and give us the address? We'll put
sure.
it in the show notes, but just so that people can, if
sure,
they're listening
the
in their
blog
car.
Address is just blog.casecomplete.com. No dots or spaces or anything or dashes in that. Just blog.casecomplete.com. And our website is www.casecomplete.com.
Well, great, Matt. I want to thank you for being on the show, share your thoughts with on use cases, and maybe we'll have you back on again in the future.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.